Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah. All right, it's that time of week. A little bit late this week, but that's still that time of week for the toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. Things are, it's just, you know, it's a busy time of year, man.
Time is a flat circle.
You have babies and jobs, and I have jobs and stuff.
Just one baby, thank God, but jobs and, yeah, stuff.
Yeah. We were kind of in the pre-show, we were talking about babies and how things were busy. And I was like, yeah, I watched a BoJack episode about that. That's pretty much where my life is. We have a lot of stuff to run through today and not a ton of time. So I think we're going to kind of just jump into stuff today. It's pretty much all from the homework. And most of it is on Netflix. Do you want to start with one of the movies on Netflix? What do you think?
Sure.
Let's go back to Dolomite Is My Name, because that seems to be a movie getting a lot of hype.
Yes.
The return of Eddie Murphy, and certainly a role that sort of showcases Eddie. And I would say has gotten some mixed reaction. Where did you land on Dolomite Is My Name?
I've not seen any of the reaction. I'm surprised it's mixed.
I would say a lot of it is to be trite about it, like cancel culture stuff. You know,
really,
maybe the idea of like, hey, maybe these movies that Rudy Ray Moore, who is the guy that Eddie Murphy plays in the film, maybe those movies that he made weren't good for culture, you know what I mean? That they're problematic, that kind of thing. And, are we elevating, blah, blah, blah. That seems to be the people who have criticisms, that seems to be the place it's coming from.
Well, I don't know. I mean, as someone who's not part of one of the exploited groups in question, I don't know what to say about that. It doesn't strike me as particularly glorifying the content of those films. And I do think it's a pretty cool story about essentially an independent filmmaker.
Yeah, I would agree. Ultimately. I would say the movie doesn't, like, I mean, the movie never, you never get the sense that the movie thinks that the movie that they're making is any good. The movie within the movie that they're making is maybe not any good is the wrong word, but they understand, I feel like, what it is that it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean?
Everyone seems to understand what's happening, and it's a guy trying to have success as a filmmaker and in part, or just as an entertainer. And in part, he's forced to adopt that absurd character because the industry isn't interested in like an adult black man.
Right.
Which
is not always necessarily a past tense thing, I think you could argue, right?
Exactly. So I would think this film has as much to say about that problem as it does things to criticize for, like, not wokeness or something.
Yeah.
But it's hard, again, I am not an aggrieved party, so it's hard for me to speak to that. I will say
the only thing I could say maybe to that regard is that I do feel like maybe the postscript where they were kind of like, yeah, Rudy basically invented hip hop. Like you might call that, you know, a little bit of the glorification, right, of some of this work. I thought maybe that was a bit. Even when I read that, I'm like, well, that's a stretch.
I guess, but are we having that conversation about the Migos? Well, their content is not good for the cult. I mean,
no, I don't think we are. With
so did is that not in the vein of Rudy Ray Moore?
Like Migos' rap is in there.
I'm just saying, like if we're going to criticize Rudy Ray Moore for consciously taking on this, you know, drug dealing pimp character, like it, and say, I don't know. I don't know a ton about Rudy Ray Moore, but I have no reason to believe that what was said in the postscript is inaccurate.
Yeah. I mean, look, I don't think you don't see Migos getting a lot of kung fu fights with women, you know, in there. Like,
No. Fine. But in his defense, there are women on both sides, you know? The guy cast a lot of women, and we can question his motives, but, like, he did. And also, again, if his goofy rhyming style spawned a particular or had a particular influence on early hip hop, why I don't know why you wouldn't say that.
Yeah, well, look, my point was that I'm fine with saying he had an influence on early hip hop, and there's certainly some latter day hip hop people who, you know, clearly were inspired or enjoyed or cited or included the Dolemite character in things like that's
Snoop
inarguable. Yeah. You know, Rudy Ray Moore was an episode of Martin, and on Big Daddy Kane and the Two Live Crew record. So yeah, like I'm not saying that he didn't. That there wasn't an influence. It just the way the title cards put it, it sort of was like, and this is how we got hip hop was sort of and like I was like, okay, well that we might be going a little far there. Regardless,
fair enough.
Let's move away from the problematic aspects of or not problematic aspects of it and talk about this as a movie. Did you like it as a movie?
I really liked it. I didn't love it. I didn't think it was spectacular in any way.
I did think as I was watching it, like, this would be in your wheelhouse. You know what I mean?
I mean, Eddie Murphy's really good, right?
Right.
Do you not agree with that?
I don't mean that as a bad thing. I just thought, you like Eddie Murphy and funk, and just seem like a lot of ingredients that you would enjoy. That's all I meant.
You're correct. Yeah, that's correct. And that's why I want to say, like, it's not a movie that I'm like, oh my God, what an incredible piece of art. But it's a movie that I liked everything about. Does that make sense?
I found it enjoyable, but I do feel like a lot of that was it's nice to have so many of these people back and being funny, surrounded you know, by people like Keegan-Michael Key. But yeah, man, it's great to see Eddie Murphy, like, you know, I don't know if he's throwing, you know, mid to upper 90s, but he's, you know, he's throwing high 80s, low 90s.
He's like a 40-year-old Nolan Ryan. Yeah. You know, it's excellent. I really think it's excellent.
I really enjoyed the Wesley Snipes character, actually.
Oh my gosh. I thought Wesley Snipes was inspired.
And playing a little bit against type, which I
yes.
Like. Yeah.
Yes. And like, you know, in an odd, He did some very bizarre and specific things, and I found it totally, like, believable.
Yeah, and I loved Keegan-Michael Key. I always loved Keegan-Michael Key, but it was cool to see.
Yeah, I mean, this was a well-acted biopic about of what I found to be a pretty funny and rather incredible story.
Yeah. You find yourself rooting for this, you know, crew of ragtag underdogs. I mean, that's clear. Like, the movie is grabbing you by the hand and pulling you in that direction, but you're very willing to go there.
Yeah, Craig Robinson does his thing. It's good stuff.
So, yeah, you know, like, for 2 hours on a Saturday afternoon, go for it. And if this is sort of the vehicle for Eddie Murphy to try some interesting stuff, then I'm here for that as well.
Well, we're supposed to be getting stand-up.
That's what I mean.
Soon.
Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? If this is his, hey, Netflix, we're gonna attach the content hose to Eddie's mouth. You know what I mean? Like, then great. Let's do that. Bring me some stand-up specials, and I'll take another movie. You know?
This is the entree to if this is how you get in the Eddie Murphy business, bravo.
Agreed. And we're also going to get another Saturday Night Live out of him too, which I, you know, in promotion of all of this.
Yeah.
Which to me is a bonus that's almost as good as just the regular thing. So
yeah, we'll see how it goes.
It's true. It could be terrible, but I'm genuinely excited for that.
Yeah, because he never actually did that.
Yeah.
Like they talked about bringing him back for that anniversary thing, and I guess he showed up, but he didn't, like, do anything.
He didn't do comedy, right? Yeah. And then he was kind of sort of – he was feuding, obviously, with the show for a long time, sort of famously. So he wasn't ever coming back. And then when he finally did, he decided he didn't want to do a bit. So, like, I'm glad that he's finally committed to doing some bits.
Yeah, should be interesting.
All right. Let's. Are you ready to transition to The Laundromat?
Yes, sir.
So that was the other Netflix movie we watched this week with ridiculously star-studded cast, I would say.
Really, really ridiculously star-studded cast. Let me ask you a question. What is the farthest? What's like the biggest gap you feel like you can experience in your, like, rating of a movie over the last, like, 3 to 5 minutes?
The biggest...
If you sit through an hour and 45 minutes and you feel one way, how much do you feel like that is capable of changing in 3 to 5 minutes?
Oh, man.
Based on the way the movie ends.
I would say you could probably at least somewhere in the neighborhood of half of how I felt about the movie could change in 3 to 5 minutes. If you just have a terrible, or I suppose on the flip side, a really brilliant ending to rescue a mediocre movie, or terrible ending to sink a really good one.
Yeah. I mean, for me, this was an ending that rescued a mediocre movie.
Oh, okay. So you like the Streep twist?
I love the Streep twist. Because here's the thing. You're watching this star-packed, very... And look, we're on record. We love Steven Soderbergh. But this was like Soderbergh doing Soderbergh doing Soderbergh.
Yeah.
Like, it was just every... Like, if there's a trite version of what Steven Soderbergh does, this was it. And when someone like Steven Soderbergh, whose name I've now said 7 times in 30 seconds, does that, you know it's on purpose, right? It's not an accident. So it's this somewhat disjointed, rather confused, overly stylistic piece that, you know, by the time I had gotten to an hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, I was like, okay, what are we? I get it. These are all vaguely related in this particular way.
It felt a little bit like Big Short with a lot less effort.
Yes. And then I kind of think, and spoiler alert, And I would recommend this movie. So if you haven't seen it, I would take a beat and skip a minute or two. When Meryl Streep addresses the camera and kind of goes, "We got to fix our stupid financial system," fist in the air, cut to black, like, I think there's so much depth to that as a filmmaking move because it's almost like saying, listen, I get it. This stuff is not that interesting or engaging, but that's how they've gotten us, is they've gotten us to a point where all these actually rather major, but now sort of commonplace offenses are too complicated and not interesting enough and, like, seemingly not related to us enough to care about. And before you know it, they, capital T, have fucked us six ways from Sunday.
Yeah. And it's not even enough, like, people don't even understand enough to be angry about it, never mind do anything.
Exactly. And I almost felt like the whole film was an analog for that. Like, yeah, here's all these little stories that, like, are kind of interesting, but whatever.
And semi-related.
Yeah, and they're kind of related, but whatever. And it's kind of, like, shot in a fun and cute way, but whatever. And then, boom, it's a gut punch at the end, in a way. And I thought it was really well executed. I thought Meryl Streep was the perfect person. The woman she played in disguise, you know, you're staring at her the whole time being like, something is not right here.
Yeah, that was tough for me. I actually thought it was a man, but I was like, this is clearly a person with wearing a crap ton of makeup. Like, that was
right.
That was very clear from jump.
It was something weird, but I never thought it was Meryl Streep.
I did not. You're right. I did not necessarily think it was Meryl Streep. Like I said, I thought it was a man.
You know, I think we could have a debate about whether it's relatively ham-handed to use your whole movie as like a metaphor for the broken financial system. But I do feel like that's what was done here, and it was incredibly slick and well pulled off. And, you know, all these up until that point, the redeeming quality was all these superstar actors are delightful.
Yeah, Lark would be the word that I would use for the main part of the movie, right? Like, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody, you know, you got a bunch of famous actors all being a little bit naughty in these
winking
little
and smiling.
Yeah, in these little vignettes, you know, where a lot of sort of crazy stuff happens. And yeah, and then the movie makes a point. And literally, I think 5 minutes might be generous. It might be 3 minutes. Essentially, the movie sort of like turns and makes the point.
It's really short and sudden and jarring. And I think it gets its point across as a result of that.
And then it sort of goes to a place because it's not like we got to fix our financial system, right? Like she says, we need meaningful campaign finance reform, right? Which is. A step from where the movie was about, right?
Like, extrapolating.
They're not talking about, like, politics doesn't even ever really come up, right? It's all just about moving money around in tax shelters, and they don't start making that connection until you see, you know, people like Obama on screen in that like final 3 minutes, you know.
And here's the thing, that again is. I think part of what ultimately makes me feel so positively about this movie is I think Steven Soderbergh and I have a lot in common in terms of the way we feel about the finance, just the way America's business system works. I'm, truth be told, probably slightly more extreme and likely less informed than Soderbergh is, but that's the thing is you're right. You don't have to mention politics because campaign finance reform has corrupted our system so much that much of the stuff that affects the finances of normal humans in America, and that's what this movie, that's what these vignettes are really about. Normal humans who are not super rich get screwed all over the place from every direction because the laws are set up to contain loopholes and cheats for the very rich.
Right.
And that's something that's not partisan and is not really political. It's classism, and it happens to be that politicians have weaseled their way into the upper class. But now virtually every politician, every major politician certainly, resides in that upper class, and they're unilaterally pursuing classist financial policy.
Campaign finance reform is actually a hobby horse of mine, and I have a lot of thoughts on it. but we don't need to get into those because I do have some commentary on that. I'm gonna put that aside for now. Because that would be a non-Totem podcast. I do feel like, while I enjoyed this movie, I do feel like Adam McKay does this sort of thing better.
Yeah, well, he does it. He does this sort of thing differently.
Differently, but with some of the same, like, you know, like when I look at the you know, the Chaney movie, I feel like
I don't want to correct you with this.
Yeah, kind of,
but
you know?
I don't want to like correct you and tell you your opinion. But I think I think what you mean is Adam McKay does this differently, and you prefer his style.
Correct.
Because I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's more precise way to say that.
Yeah, because I think I agree with you. But I do think Steven Soderbergh has done precisely what he wanted to do.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I love Soderbergh. Like, I'm not saying Adam McKay's a better director than Steven Soderbergh. You know, like, that's not my point.
No, you're saying you'd rather see an Adam McKay version of, like, a send-up political message satire movie than you would a Steven Soderbergh. But
I would have rather seen Adam McKay do this movie than Steven Soderbergh. Where do you land on this movie,
generally speaking?
I would say the reserve thumbs up is what I would say. I did not like it quite as much as you did, but I didn't think it was bad either. You know?
I would imagine we were in a very similar place up until the last 3 to 5 minutes, and I think that boosted it more for me than it did for you, probably.
Yeah, I'd say that's accurate.
But I do think, like, it's the sort of movie where 3/4, 5/6, 7/8 of the way in, you might think it's a bit of a mess, and as it turns out, everything is in its right place. Whether you love the way it comes together or not, it's much more precise than it seems.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. There's more happening here than you realize, you know, because by design, I would say.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
What'd you think?
So an interesting movie. Two interesting movies, really. A good movie week in Netflix.
Yeah. All right. We have two HBO shows to get to, but there's one more Netflix thing. So let's handle that, and then we'll jump into HBO land. Kominsky Method is back. I don't have a ton to say about this. I feel like, you know, if you liked Kominsky Method season one,
yeah,
you'll still be here for this.
Right.
It's kind of settling in to the groove that it's in, and that's neither good nor bad. It just is. You know what I mean?
I think that's fair, although I would say it is a good show.
Yeah, it's a good show. We liked it then, you know.
Yeah. That sounded particularly like a middling response, and I was reminded of why I liked it watching it. But if your point is it's not necessarily a new formula, then certainly you're right.
Don't you think a lot of, like, why we liked it, though, was like, oh, wow, Chuck Lorre, like, did a show, and we actually liked this one. I felt like that was some of it, right? Some of that, and then the, you know, the lead performances, right? Like, that's a lot of the appeal, at least for us in season one, I felt like.
Yes, but I think to say it that way about Chuck Lorre discredits what impressed us and surprised us, which is that it's a really well-written thing that has some real emotional resonance and is not just canned jokes.
Agreed.
And I think that continues. Like, I only watched a couple episodes, but there's really great lines and thoughtful stuff and funny ideas about what it must be like to be in a man of that age, you know? And I find it really, maybe it's because I'm getting old, but I find it really entertaining and engaging.
Yeah. It does definitely remind you that you were also getting old, you know? You in the colloquial sense, not you in the
right. I do think, like, the under 30s are probably not that entertained by this.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of flashing lights on this show that to just say not for you if you're
right.
30. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So yeah, but if you like season one of Kominsky Method, then yeah. Get
Come on
in.
Back.
Yeah. The water's fun. and I guess you could sort of say a similar thing about Silicon Valley. You know what I mean? Like, the show obviously has changed a lot over the years, so it's not exactly the same show that it was when it began. You know, but I feel like it's just sort of on the track to its conclusion at, you know, the end of the season.
Yes. See, well, that's what I think. I think you said there sneakily the difference. It has a downhill running out of road feel to it.
Yeah.
And I, not in a bad way. In a good way, I think. But this is definitely a show that feels like it is in the process of running its course. And it's aware of it. And it's like if... if you're knitting a scarf, okay? As someone who knits. If you're knitting a scarf, like... most of it, you're just kind of going back and forth knitting across the scarf, and maybe there's a little bit of patterning, but you're really just back and forth knitting rows. And on the last row, you got to like sort of tie some things off. It's like a little different. And they're tying some things off. Like if the first season of a show or the first couple seasons are like casting out a wide net, they're like pulling the net back in, and you can sort of, you feel it. And I'm excited because I kind of feel like there's going to be some, you know, characters we haven't seen in a while who pop up. Like, I think there's going to – they seem to be – it just feels like a creative team in terms of the people making the show that are really in control of the final stretch.
Interesting. I thought you were going to sort of go to a different place with that knitting analogy.
Oh.
In that, like, the idea of, like, you know, you're getting to the end of this scarf or whatever it is, that you're sort of locked in, right, at that point, because you've laid so much yarn that you have to finish the scarf, and there's only so many ways you can finish the scarf, you know what I mean?
I think that's true, too. I think that's true, too. And again, like, it doesn't have to be a bad thing that you can feel it ending. But they definitely, like, it's not a new scarf.
Yeah. And in some senses, that's fine. Like, I could watch, 10, 12 more episodes that would consist mostly of Roman, messing with people in the office. Like, just Roman and Dinesh's, like, ongoing... You know, like,
oh,
I could, you know, and occasionally, like,
hilarious.
Big Head popping up and being stupid. Like, yeah, I could.
Yeah.
I could do that for sure. I do think, though, given that there's so much fertile ground for what's happening outside of the toy department in Silicon Valley. For this show to still run through, and that there are a lot of things it could say about what's happening now that I don't know that it necessarily,
like,
did that in episode one in the way that I know this show is capable of. Like, to me...
Well, are you talking sexual harassment stuff?
No, I'm talking about, like, for example, the notion of Richard testifying to Congress... You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Sure, you could just use that as a premise for Richard to just be super awkward in a public setting, you know, in the same way that he would puke in front of a new staff of employees.
But he also, I mean, he also uses it to...
You're right. They go a slightly different way, but,
yeah.
Like, you could also actually use this as a way to really say something about what's going on with Mark Zuckerberg and Jack Dorsey and some of these folks, because there's very real, very, you know, culturally trenchant issues happening. I realize that, you know, they made this show a few months ago now, so they weren't necessarily the same issues then, but
right,
there's still a lot of ground to cover, you know what I mean?
Agreed, but I mean, I think they did what this show would do to address the privacy issues.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, I guess I don't. That's.
I mean, that's what this. I don't know that you can expect this show to be like David Simon all of a sudden.
I'm not saying it should be David Simon. I do think this show has had a lot of interesting, smart things to say about Silicon Valley culture, and I feel like this time it more went for finishing the scarf than necessarily what am I saying about privacy you know, and the internet. And what am I saying about the way that these tech executives, the way that they act when they're asked to be held accountable?
But I mean, I think they've said that stuff in the same way all along, like by with Gavin Belson being like a
that these guys are just ridiculous, clueless douches, pretty much.
Yeah. You know, I mean, my point is not that's an accurate encapsulation of the full picture of a Mark Zuckerberg or a Jack Dorsey, but that is more or less how they've addressed. Like, they have never. This has never been halt and catch fire or any of that.
No.
You know what I mean? It's just it's a very. Ultimately, at the end of the day, this show is a deeply stupid satire about nerds.
Yeah, sure. I do think that Silicon Valley itself is now wrestling with the moment, maybe now more than ever, of like, oh, did it turn out we actually are evil? Right? Wasn't our model was supposed to be don't be evil, but it turns out we're evil.
And but they literally said that in this episode. Like, yeah, right. They literally referenced that motto and made the point that it's an absurd hypocrisy in this episode, and I don't think they ever go much further than that.
Right. I guess that's what I'm saying. It's like, this seems like a moment where maybe you could, and they're not necessarily interested in that.
Yeah, but I don't think they ever have been. I'm not sure it's fair to expect Silicon Valley to be super interested in the deeper philosophical implications.
I mean, look, man, Mike Judge made Idiocracy, which I think has turned out to be a pretty, like, you know, a hindsight introspective statement about where we're currently at. You know what I mean? So,
see, but that's only because you haven't watched it recently. I think what it turned out to be is unfortunately prescient.
Oh,
but
maybe but that's it. You're right. I haven't seen it in a minute.
Idiocracy is also exceedingly stupid. Like, that's not a criticism. It's a stylistic choice.
It's trying to be stupid. Yeah.
Yes. And unfortunately, we have gotten very stupid as a society, but I don't think that movie was ever that movie or the show were ever intended to have more than broad social critiques. They're also at their core
broad comedies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, I think Office Space clearly had some prescient ideas as well.
Yeah, Mike Judge is like, I bet if Mike Judge wrote an essay about Silicon Valley, you'd be satisfied. But that's not what this show is.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I really hope Mike Judge continues to make more television shows after this one, though.
Me too. He's very funny and clever.
Yeah. I expect that he will. I have no reason to think that he won't. All right, so the other show kind of in the Sunday Night HBO block now is Mrs. Fletcher. This is the pilot episode that aired this week, and I'm wondering, you know, we have sort of expressed our admiration for Catherine Hahn on the show in the past, and obviously here for that.
Yeah.
Did the pilot fall right in line with that for you?
In terms of Catherine Hahn appreciation, yes. It's very pilot-y.
That was my feeling as well. Of like,
it's like, I think we kind of the last like 1 minute is like a preview of what the real show is, and it feels like the rest of the episode is preamble.
Yeah, you know, you're getting to that look on her face, right?
Exactly. You're getting to the final scene where she starts to look at porn, closes the computer, and then is like, you know what? Maybe I want to see this after all.
Yeah, and you're right. There's
the
a lot of setup with
douche.
The son, you know, that
feels
like it's for a thing, right? I think college is going to turn out to be a very different experience for him. You know,
I sure hope so, because
sort of
I can't watch him be a dirtbag and like just get away with it for a season.
Yeah, no, they really pour the dirtbag, you know. Over the top.
Yeah, if I have a criticism of the piloty pilot, it's like, other than that, you know, it doesn't feel like it's really part of whatever we're about to watch. It's that the kid is a caricature. I mean, how big of a high school douchebag can you be?
they really went for that. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There's no room to be confused about what kind of high school character her son is.
Yeah. I don't know. I do think it's interesting to like watch the sensitive guy dad from 13 be like
an absentee father.
Yeah, a sensitive on the outside but totally absent douchey on the inside guy in this. That'll be interesting. I'm curious to see if he has more of an expanded role in future.
Yeah,
episodes.
I mean, if that's another thing I'd say is, you know, when you say expanded role, the only character in the pilot who feels like they have any depth whatsoever is the Catherine Hahn character.
Yeah. I don't feel like I have enough to give a recommendation to someone either way on this show.
No, I agree. We should probably circle back in a couple weeks.
I'm going to continue to watch it, I think.
I do think for me the Han equity goes a long way.
It does. And also, doesn't the HBO equity go a long way? Like, you kind of have Sunday night blocked off and you're going to watch Silicon Valley and you're going to watch John Oliver, so you're probably going to watch the show in between it.
Yeah, except I don't watch them live or anything.
Yeah,
so that's,
I know.
Not an issue. But I am watching Watchmen, so yeah. I mean, I've got the whole Sunday night slate, and I'm pretty locked in for now. For now.
Yeah, I'm not saying I wouldn't bail on the show if it doesn't turn out to be satisfying.
Well, not just that. I do think the leash would be a lot shorter if it was insert random actress I don't care about in the lead role.
Also true. Yeah, yeah. I'm not denying the Catherine Hahn part. I was just saying I feel like, at least for me, there is a certain amount of HBO trust that's in that mix as well.
Sure.
Okay. That actually concludes the things that we had lined up to talk about. Real quick, do you want to mention that the Warrior season is over after four games?
Yeah.
Pretty wild. I mean, yep. You know, we thought there might be trouble. We've talked about this before.
Well, here's what we said. And I don't know if we said this specifically on this podcast, but here's what we knew. Certainly, I know you knew, and I would imagine any attentive basketball fan, certainly Warriors fan, knew what this team could not afford at any point was an extended injury absence for Steph Curry. Probably not for Draymond Green or D'Angelo Russell either.
I would say almost certainly for Draymond. Because the defense is so bad from what we saw as it was. Like, I can't even imagine what it would be without Draymond back there.
Well, except the defense is so bad, how much does one defensive player matter? He's obviously not solving their problems there. But whatever, that's either – however indispensable you think Draymond is, I don't think there's really an argument that Steph Curry is more indispensable.
Fair, yes.
He is. Yeah. He was – this season, he was – one of the two or three most indispensable players in the league, just in terms of his team remaining anything like what you would hope or expect them to be. And the fact is, not only had they looked really bad, and I will tell you, I mean, this is a moot point now, but people were calling me crazy as I was saying this last night, but and I'm trying to make sure I say it the right way, because I want to be clear, the defense is bad. They're a bad defensive team.
Bad is, I feel like, not a descriptive enough word for a team that gives up 45 points in a quarter at home to the Phoenix Suns.
But that's the thing. Did you watch that game?
I did not watch that game. It was not available to me where I was.
Yeah. Oh, it is, though, because it's free league pass.
I thought that was only the first week.
Oh, yeah. Crap. I guess that ended Tuesday, huh? Yeah. Anyway, here's the thing. Yes, it's bad, but I do think it's just bad. Like, you know, sixth worst in the league level bad. What made it atrocious was the way they were playing offense. They were turning the ball over lazily and like in scoring fashion. They in that in the one stretch of, so the Phoenix game was remarkable in that it was 40 minutes of a competitive game, and in the other 8 to 10, Phoenix had like a 35-4 run. And in that run, they had like a 15-point points off turnover count. And it's just, when you're already a bad defensive team, if you just start throwing the ball away into fast break opportunities, like, it spirals out of control quick because guys get comfortable and hot, and then they hit a couple tough shots in addition to the breakaway, and you're done.
Yeah, look, I don't doubt the turnovers contribute to it, but I would also say that, you know, when you start a game 45-15, you can't really talk about the rest of the stretch being competitive because the incentives have drastically changed at that point.
Yeah, except that Phoenix is like, that's truer later in the season. But again, this is all a moot point because without Steph Curry, none of this matters. Because my whole point was going to be the way to solve how poorly things were going with Steph Curry was for Steph Curry's offense to be much better, because he was one of the main culprits in terms of turning it over and not executing.
Well, and look, it's not like turning it over hasn't been an issue for even the gilded versions of the Warriors, right? So,
well, and but that's sort of the point. Again, a now moot point was, sure, part of the problem with the Warriors is they lost a lot, ton of young guys, not quite sure what you're going to get from them night to night. But nearly as big a part of the problem was the stars have developed sloppy habits because for 5 years, or at least for 3 years, it didn't matter.
Can I give you a quick sports talk radio segment here?
Is it the Warriors should tank? Because that's absolutely the case.
Well, that's part of it. But here's my sports talk segment.
Okay.
You know, coming up, we'll tell you why last night was good for the Warriors. I do think long term this actually could work out to their benefit. And you know,
I think that is a horribly depressing thing to say and absolutely dead on, because here's the most important thing. This is a bone injury to Steph Curry's left hand. This is not a significant concern for his future.
Right.
If Steph Curry had badly sprained an ankle or messed up a knee, there's no way you could spin it positive.
Right.
So but because this is like not a soft tissue, just a bone injury that will heal fine on his non-shooting hand, you essentially get freedom to embrace the tank, and all that does is improve your position for next year when you're also going to get back a guy who I think we all have to admit was probably more valuable than we realized in Klay Thompson.
And you see the mileage, right? And right, you maybe seen there was a tweet going around yesterday talking about how, right, within the course of 6 competitive games, you had major injuries to Kevin Durant, Klay Thompson, and Steph Curry.
Which brings me to step 2 of the tank, Draymond Green load management.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You come up with an injury for Draymond Green. You know what I mean?
Well, you just know. It's very easy. You don't have to now. It's this simple. The guys who played 30-plus minutes for five straight years of finals appearances, their bodies are all wearing out. We've got some medical data that we can't show you that tells us that if we don't rest Draymond Green against good teams or against mediocre teams that he might lead us to a win over, then we're going to have real trouble with his body as well. So we're doing the smart precautionary thing, and we're going to sit him out tonight. It's not because this is a game we thought we might win accidentally if he played. It's just because our data tells us his body needs a rest.
Yep. And I think
that's how you do it.
I think they'll do that. I think they'll get as good a draft pick as they can. And I would say,
and by the way, if they finish with like the 7th or 8th worst, here's the thing. They want to finish with the 11th worst because they have they're good because it's top 20 protected. So if they finish with like the 6th best record, their odds of getting a top 3 pick is way better than it was a few years ago.
Yeah, those have moved up. So look, you can get a good pick. I would throw this, and I'm going to say this without – I haven't looked at any of the salary cap ramifications of this, so forgive me if it's not a possible thing. But we know that the team here in Minnesota had significant interest in D'Angelo Russell.
You can't trade him until at least December 15th.
Understand you can't trade him until midseason. And it doesn't matter if this happens in midseason, the offseason, whenever. But if you could trade Russell to Minnesota and get Covington back in that deal,
yep.
Then all of a sudden you come back next year with Steph, Clay, Dre, Covington,
yep.
High-end draft pick of some sort. Yep. You know,
maybe the T-Wolves pick as well.
Yeah, healthier Kevon Looney, you give in all of these young guys some actual minutes and game experience, and you hope yep. at least one or two of them get better, and yep. you've saved a year of mileage on some guys who badly need some rest. And then yep. all of a sudden, I feel like you have a team that actually is the team that maybe we thought this year's team could be next year or even better, you know, coming around next season.
Yep. You perfectly described the formula, and you're doing basically the radio show that I am going to do this afternoon.
And look, I think the Warriors team obviously is much smarter than I am and probably have figured all this out already. But yeah,
I mean, the question is just, do they have the stomach for the tank?
Yeah. And we'll I think they do. I think they do. To me, the biggest question about that is you've got a brand new arena with crazy expensive tickets. And I have a feeling you're going to see a lot of empty seats because it's going to be a lot of money.
Well, let me be clear.
For bad basketball.
That's what I mean about the stomach for the tank. Does Joe Lacob have the stomach to roll out a loser in his shiny new building every night, knowing it's the best way to get a winner here soon? I don't know the answer to that. I do think Lacob has shown restraint and the forethought in the past. So fingers crossed, but we'll see.
I think he's smart enough. I think he's smart enough to get it. And honestly, I don't think he has much choice because there's not really what's the road to this team being competitive in this season?
Well, and let's be totally honest about this too. Let's just say that trade you're talking about is available, and whatever other assets Minnesota's giving you are not viable players right now. If you, as the Warriors, once Steph is back, because he'll be back by the time you're even able to trade D'Angelo Russell in all likelihood, are you sure this is not a better team with Robert Covington than it is with D'Lo? Like, I think Russell's probably a better player, certainly long-term a better player than Robert Covington, but Covington is a catch-and-shoot defensive wing, which is kind of a thing the Warriors don't have and desperately need.
Yeah. And look, we understand that no knock on D'Angelo Russell when I say this, but you know, having D'Angelo and Steph in the same backcourt is a real problem for you defensively. Just is.
It's a big problem defensively. Yes.
We all knew it that like none of that is a surprise. But
that's right.
It's also a reality. So
and they've also, you know, it didn't help that they were missing all of their bigs for the first three games. Like they a lot of things conspired to get this season off to an ugly start. And I still believe if Steph was healthy, they'd have a shot at winning 40 something games and threatening for a playoff position. But if I'm sure he's going to miss in the 4 to 6 week range with a broken bone, just out of caution, if nothing else. And I can't see this team competing in that scenario. So I think you got to just go.
Yeah.
Nosedive.
And look, most teams, I would say that if your ceiling, like if things go right, we win 40 something games and compete for a low end playoff spot, most teams in that position are already better off tanking. So
that may be true. And I think this team was possibly different because of the specter of Klay Thompson. But again, now it's obvious.
Yeah, it's obvious. So I think that's the way they'll go. All right. Let's.
And you know what? Look, as someone who has to cover the Warriors, it's a bit of a bummer that I'm going to watch so many losses.
Yeah.
As someone who's a basketball fan, I'm not against some new blood. This means that someone out of like the Mavericks, Pelicans, you know, that sort of intriguing group that the Warriors were going to be in competition with, one of the younger teams is likely to get in instead. The Kings, I don't know.
Yeah, although the Kings, you know, starting off 0-5, that's put a real dent into, I would say, right? Like, starting off 0-5 has put a real dent.
That's why I left them for the end. But the T-Wolves are in there, too. If Cat can stop punching people and stays on the floor and keeps playing like this, like, they're going places, too.
It's interesting, though. I think the view here of last night's particular incident was that actually Cat did what Cat needed to do, and that it was a good thing. I don't think you want him punching people every night, but you wanted him punching people last night. You know what I mean?
I agree.
Yeah.
Because the it's tough. I would not pursue a social media war of words with Joel Embiid if I were an NBA player. Like, that's just not an avenue I would pursue. If he wants to post about it, so be it. I'm staying silent. And that way, at least if people talk about me, they're going to have to say, well, he didn't engage.
I think what Kat did, I think post the photos and then say nothing. Post the photos and then just silent. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's what I would.
That's why I said, yeah, like, you don't want the war of words with Embiid, because he's sort of in like a PR Q rating zone where even if he kind of loses, like, he's going to be declared the winner. And like, I don't want that. But
I sort of think that's what happened last night. Don't you? Like, he was pretty much a total douche, but everyone's like, oh my God, Joel Embiid will say anything. I love it.
Yes, but I don't know. It's funny because I wasn't watching the game, and all the angles I saw come in kind of late, so it's hard to see how
Cameron
the
didn't really get the whole thing, I feel like.
Right. But Cat definitely swung, and that is always bad news for how many games you'll be playing.
Yeah, but I think the Joel Embiid talking, and particularly given that it's going to come in a pattern, I think Embiid may wind up with more. Like, Cat's going to get a significant suspension, I think. But I have a feeling Embiid may get more because he just kept going. You know what
I mean?
It'll
be interesting, and it's probably already done by the time anyone listens to this.
I mean,
so we should stop talking about it.
You're calling somebody a pussy in writing. I got a feeling that the NBA is going to come down for that alone. You know what I mean? So,
oh, man. See, you know, I think this is where our basketball tastes split. And it just the easiest way to explain it is there's two kinds of NBA fans, Kevin Garnett fans and Kevin Garnett haters.
Yes. And you were definitely in the first camp, and I'm definitely in the latter.
And there it is. And I think that describes how we see this interaction quite well. But that said, if you're on the receiving end of the, ceremonial Kevin Garnett shit talking from whoever, and you're Carl Anthony Towns, whose toughness and mental acumen has been questioned, I'm with you. Like,
that's why you got to swing, right? You got to swing.
You got to throw that punch, man. If a guy is in your face calling you a pussy over and over again, you don't have an option here.
Yeah, if you lay back and take it, it's going to come to you every night. You know what I mean?
Right. Exactly. And if it costs you a couple games this time, hopefully it saves you a whole lot of pain in the ass over the next decade.
Yeah. I'd argue his team needed to see it too. Yeah. So.
And frankly, his team has already seen the way he's bringing it with the ball. So if you're not inspired to play next to Carl Anthony Towns right now, I can't help you, man.
Yeah, that's fair. I love that they're running the offense through him. I'm not sure that this team has enough talent still. I think it's going to be a real issue for them. And some of this hot start has been schedule.
And some of this hot start has been like it's a hot zone for Andrew Wiggins.
Yes. Last night was not a hot zone for Andrew Wiggins, and you saw them get their ass kicked. I mean, Wiggins is shooting 23% from three on the season at this point. So
But I'm just saying, like, when he plays well, they're really good. When he disappears, they're not nearly as good.
Yeah, and the disappearing still happens too much. All right, we could talk about basketball all day. That's probably what we do when we're not. We should go. Let's do homework.
Okay.
We have a brief homework list this week. Yeah.
What'd you say?
We have a brief homework list this week, I would say.
Well, you say that now, except while we were talking, something reminded me of another thing we're supposed to do for homework, and now I've forgotten it again.
Okay.
You brought up a person or a thing that I was like, oh yeah, that person's thing. This is great content.
All right, here's what I have, and you tell me if you've forgotten anything else. So, okay. His Dark Materials is premiering on HBO. Are you familiar with the source material here on His
Not
Dark
really.
Materials? Me neither. So, but, you know, I think it's another thing like Watchmen.
You know what I'm familiar with?
What?
Ruth Wilson.
Oh, yeah. I am also familiar with Ruth Wilson. I'm surprised that you were super familiar with her because you're kind of just not, you're not an Affair person at all, right? Have we ever talked about Affair on the show?
No, but she's the star of Luther.
Oh, that's where you're at. Okay, gotcha. Fair enough. All right, end of the
Also, my wife watches all the British stuff.
Oh,
so
and she's in a lot of that.
You bump into her every now and then. And yeah. She's in a silly network show I like called Elementary, starring Johnny Lee Holmes.
I didn't know she was in that.
What's his name? Sherlock Holmes is the character.
Lucy Liu's in that, right?
Yeah, Lucy Liu and Johnny Lee Miller. That's his name.
Still can't bother to watch it. All right,
it's enjoyable. It's not great, but it's enjoyable.
End of the Fucking World Season 2 happens on Tuesday.
Yes.
We're in on that. We're also going to try to see the Ed Norton passion project, Motherless Brooklyn.
Yes, it's getting great reviews.
It is. I'm sure it's going to be awesome. For me, it's just going to be an availability. But I'm going to be in L.A. this weekend, and I'm damn sure it's playing in L.A. So,
yes.
The question will be, will I have time to spend 2 hours in the movies when I'm technically on vacation? So we're going to see that. We're going to try to see all those things. We have a long overdue challenge discussion. I got through about half of the most recent episode of the challenge, so we're not quite ready to talk about what's happening.
My God.
But just that half has been a doozy.
You don't know, man. You don't even know.
And, I am happy, and I say this without having seen the conclusion, and I don't know if anyone winds up pushing this button, but I'm at least happy that the switching teams button is finally, like, coming into play, at least a little bit. But mm-hmm. The level of intrigue on the show that's happening now and these inner team alliances and the friends turning on each other.
Remarkable.
Yeah. And then just the villainous nature of some of the people on the show right now. We may need to just do a whole sorting out of whose side are you on?
Aside whose side I'm on, like Ashley and Jordan both lean so hard into the villain role. It's goofy, but it's also like necessary. And I just love that Jordan clearly conscious of it. And I think Ashley to a degree as well. They're just like, look, somebody has to embrace this villain role and just be villainous.
Yeah, they're
all
like,
the time.
Wes is off the show. So who's
exactly.
picking up that torch?
I'm gonna take care of this, you guys. No worries. And
I think you can make an easy case that Paulie and Cara Marie are the villains of the show. So
yes, but they're not embracing it. That's a sneaky thing.
Right.
That's different. Right. That's like deep challenge.
Paulie embraces it sometimes. Paulie embraces it sometimes. I'd say.
I don't think he's conscious of it though. Like Jordan. Jordan, it like some of the shit he says into the camera, man.
Jordan just, it oozes out of him. It's pretty good.
Yeah. It's spectacular. And especially, you know, with Kyle gone and as you said, Wes gone, like people had to pick up some slack and boy, have they.
This show is Shakespearean if everyone in Shakespeare plays was just a complete dumbass.
Oh, my God.
Right?
But, you know, sometimes they are.
Like,
it's just a comedy. It's a Shakespearean comedy.
Yeah, just broady dumbasses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's a Midsummer Night's challenge.
All right. So we will have a more in-depth challenge discussion. I know we've been sort of dancing around that for a couple weeks, but I promise that's going to happen. Does any of that jog the thing that was in your brain?
This is killing me, man. Just killing me. It was something right in the middle of the show. I don't know why I didn't write it down.
Oh, well. Can I just say one thing then before we go?
Uh-huh.
You know, this is not a surprise to you because we talked about it during the week. The Deuce ended on Monday.
Oh, that's what it is. Because I brought up David Simon.
Oh, that's what it was. Okay.
We're going to talk about the Deuce next week.
Oh, you're gonna try to catch up.
I'm going to catch up. I've already made some headway. I'm going to catch up by next. I'm going to finish it by next week because we can't not talk about the end of the Deuce.
Yeah. I mean, like, I mean, I'm giving a little bit away. Like,
spoilers.
I really loved the last two episodes in particular. So I would like to discuss them. You're honestly, at this point, you're the only person I know who watches this show. So
it's funny because I know a few and unilaterally they have said whatever you think about X, Y, or Z, they really wrapped it up wonderfully.
Oh, good. Good. Yeah. Yes, they stuck the landing and people should know. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like at this point, if you've watched more than one David Simon show, you should know. If you're in season one and you're kind of like, hang with it, man, because it's so rewarding in season three. All right, we'll get back to we'll get more in depth on that next week. I'm really excited for you to watch that and hear what you have to say.
Excellent, can't wait.
All right, let's wrap this puppy up.
Oh, sorry. Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed. The lights out. Butter's getting hard. The eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody,
and do me a favor. Have yourself a tremendous evening.